research collaboration is about solidarity, not exploitation, not power relation.
In the worst, but in the worst case, we are ruining people's lives with our research.
I'm always intrigued that these issues are always how these issues are framed. And how they're framed, it seems to me, always reflect white concerns rather than black interests.
My brother's gone, but the Floyd name still lives on.
The real revolution of this week is black people and white people coming together and talking about what racism feels like, what it is.
Welcome to Conflict Zone from the LSC, with me, Azaria Morgan, and my co-producer, Luke Cooper. This is the second series of Conflict Zone, the podcast exploring the nature of organised violence in the 21st century. We take a look at the causes and drivers of intractable wars. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power driving organised violence in the modern world. This series is produced by the Conflict Research Programme based at LSC Ideas and funded by the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office.
In this episode, we introduce the Silent Voices Project in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We begin by suggesting how to start the conversation for decolonizing practices in academia by creating spaces for open dialogue. We explore some theoretical approaches which might help to explain why hierarchical attitudes towards the Global South have persisted among the scholarly community in the Global North. Finally, we advocate a multifaceted approach and emphasise the importance of navigating conflict sites through the lens of gender.
Part 1. Creating spaces and starting the conversation.
Part of the reason why a lot of students of colour are alienated from their education system is because it doesn't represent the histories that they come from.
More education, black awareness. I want to be able to have that in this country.
It might seem obvious, but it's crucial. To start the decolonisation process, we need to have open conversations. We need to create an environment where all voices can be heard. This was the approach taken by the Silent Voices Project. The project aims to generate self-reflective dialogues in order to inform research efforts that contribute to decolonising academia.
The Silent Voices Project is an initiative led by the Governance in Conflict Network at Ghent University. It is a collective of researchers studying development, conflict, and post-conflict studies working across Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Europe. The project strives for open dialogues on the practice of transnational collaboration in academic field research. Professor Koen Vlassenroot, director of the Conflict Research Group at Ghent University, was heavily involved in the project in Bukavu, a city in eastern DRC. He explains the origins of the project and how it grew from a workshop in 2015 to be part of the ongoing debate about decolonization in academia.
We had a two-day meeting with a number of research programs were bringing together their researchers, including those of Research Institute I've been working with for many years, and which is also a partner of the CRP, just to talk about research experiences, just to talk about challenges, just to talk about existing practices and how people have tried to cope with these challenges, and also particularly with emotional and ethical challenges. And that was a rather confrontational and very emotional meeting, which created a lot of space to open up, and people started talking little by little. Also, those white-skinned who were there, because, you know, it's been, everyone was starting to share stories. So we did it a couple of times, and at some point we thought, well, maybe we should write those stories down. And we saw that also as a writing experiment. We've been thinking about, you know, what can be an easy way for people to tell their stories, and thought, well, blog posts seem to serve that purpose quite well. So we invited everyone to come up with ideas, to start writing. We've been editing, reviewing, rewriting. And it took us a long time. So people presented their blogs, rediscussed things, and then in the end, we started posting them on the website.
The Bukavu series of blogs generated a lot of feedback and has since been collated into a book. Complementing these articles were illustrations drawn by Congolese political cartoonist Tembo Cash. The cartoons offer a visual medium for understanding and interpreting the power dynamics at play. Due to their interpretive nature, they are applicable across disciplines, not just the social sciences. The cartoons were then used as a resource in and of themselves to feature as an online exhibition. Some find them uncomfortable and disturbing, as it forces them to confront their own bias and practices. Others applaud the expo for its clever portrayal of these tough issues in a creative and non-prescriptive way.
Indeed, cartoons are tools to elicit humour, often satire. They are often exaggerated but highlight a particular feature or poignant issue. Pablo Suarez specialises in the use of cartoons as an educational and training tool. He writes that cartoons invite us to recognise reality as ridiculous, inexcusable, needing change. Once armed with that irrefutable awareness, it's easier to reflect and discuss candidly what's really going on and what to do about it. Cohn describes the key themes of the Bukavu series.
There's a number of core messages that come out of it. It's about existing power relations, which in a way can be framed as sort of neocolonial practices, but I'm not a big fan of calling it neocolonialism because it's going beyond that. It's more than that. It's also about, you know, how you deal with collaborators. It's about giving them visibility. And then there's a whole issue about care. How are these people exposed? Are research assistants, research associates, there's a tendency to expose them to you know, when specific regions become too difficult to visit because of security reasons or whatever, we tend to outsource that, right? But without providing the necessary protection. When people come back and feel stressed because of extreme pressure to produce, but also emotional stress because of challenges they're faced with. Many of us have been experiencing acts of violence and so on. There's no care. There's nothing. We just leave it like that. And, you know, this is about academia, people writing writing those blog posts have been working as researchers in support of other researchers and so on. But it's also for people doing some bits and pieces of work as consultants and research for international NGOs. So the aid, the humanitarian sector is suffering from exactly the same. So it's not only about academia. And it is not only about neocolonial practices. It's also the way you deal with people, the way you respect people. And there is very blunt racism all over the place, absolutely. But it is shocking to hear so many stories coming back to us, people wanting to share their stories now with us, telling me what, well, so yeah, is it, but you know, we need to move forward. We have to take this as a starting point of reflection, not to necessarily condemn practices, but to change them.
The project has an explicitly practical orientation to change how research is undertaken and how knowledge is produced.
I see this whole process as an environment which hopefully will inspire people who go to conflict areas and do research as a PhD student, to big principal investigators of research grants, to donors funding research. So I hope in the end it will help us to rethink international research cooperation, which indeed should be based on a number of ethical elements and which should be based on equity and equality and so on.
The Bukavu series not only highlights North-South power relations in research collaborations, but also touches on other ethical issues, specifically the lack of standards in place for local researchers or subcontractors working in conflict and post-conflict zones. A number of the blogs in the series discuss traumatic experiences of researchers wrestling with anxiety or questionable data collection methods as a means of survival. Is this institutional negligence or malpractice on behalf of donors or research institutions, or are they willfully turning a blind eye? Cohn offers some guidance.
When these blogs are disrupting for those who read it, well, it's a good thing. I don't want to shock people. I don't want to give them bad feelings. It's just like, oh, wait a minute. Maybe I should change a couple of things as well. Or maybe I should talk to my ethical committee at my university that we should revise a couple of things. Because indeed, a number of ethical standards are usually imposed on us being based in the global north, which is good, but not necessarily count for people we work with. As long as we have cleared our conscience, it's fine. And we seriously underestimate the impact of research activities on those research associates and assistants. We seriously underestimate, because we found out from this process that there's not much space for them just to tell what they have gone through, just to tell how they feel, just to complain when they are underpaid, when there is no contract, when there is no health insurance in place. All these things, people just don't raise it, because it's sometimes just there is a power relationship. So in other cases, people need the money. But in the worst case, we are ruining people's lives, associating them. So we need to be very careful, because an outside researcher enters somewhere, extract data, goes back, and case closed. But some people are left there, having participated to research, and then all sorts of demands and experiences they cannot cope with. So, but the researcher is gone, so it's no longer his or her priority. You see, so there's all sorts of things that we need to acknowledge in order to seriously rethink the way we do research.
By creating a space for reflection and dialogue, the Bukavu series has also broached sometimes taboo subjects, such as researchers experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder following work in conflict sites. By discussing these experiences, the project has contributed to challenging what can sometimes be a culture of silence, reproducing a masculinized notion that trauma is the price to pay and you should just get used to it. Cohn reflects on how the project has sought to dislodge this thinking.
It is not the price to pay. You don't have to pay a price. Maybe in that case, people should do research elsewhere. There's so many things we need to discover in this world and we need to understand in this world. So the only thing I'm trying to say here, and this is also part of this whole process, is that, you know, it's not that we should not work in those environments anymore. We should just be very critical in our own thinking about it. Yeah. And look also at the effects. If people get back from a specific area and had a bad time and can't sleep for weeks afterwards, you know, these things happen. These things can happen anywhere. But if there is no care, then the problem is not necessarily, maybe it's not per se that people come back with bad stories. Well, that is an issue, of course. But it's even worse when there's no care afterwards.
Institutions must recognize in their research processes that they have a duty of care to all researchers, and especially those at an early career stage. Cohn sees opportunities for change.
There's institutional issues with this. Mm-hmm. It's not part of research proposals in most cases. There's, you know, you need ethical clearance from your institution, but these kind of things are not necessarily part of that. And that, of course, those conducting research, those supervising research should be sensitive to these things. And I have to say, I see things changing also. This is not a very pessimistic story I'm bringing. I see a lot of space for change, and I see, and there is a lot of things that a lot of people are thinking about this. I've been contacted by humanitarian organizations, by donor fundings, by diplomats, like, whoa, this is interesting. Oh, there's so much things, there's so much of this we didn't know about, but what can we do about it? There is a lot of, there's opportunity to change. And again, I'm not saying that what is coming out of this process should be the starting point of a reflection, but I hope to contribute to it in some way.
Key to this is ensuring the conventional ethical process also takes into account the needs of the researcher and also collaborators in the global south.
You need ethical clearance of ethical committees. Every university has that in place. Also, donors impose that ethical clearance. But in many cases, it's about the ethics of the researcher from the institution and not about the collaborators. And so there is still a long way to go. These things can be improved and it should also have a wider meaning, not only for the researchers coming from. It's not the way you as a member of a specific institute, you do research and you work with people. It's also about people you work with. There's a number of standards you have to take into account.
So there are practical ways we can improve how the research community is undertaking its work. But the Bukavu project experiences have also been drawn on to develop a theoretical way of thinking about these issues.
Part 2. A theoretical approach to understanding global North-South divides.
Dr. Emery Madinga is the director of the Angaza Institute and associate professor at the Higher Institute for Rural Development, Bukavu. He is one of the contributing researchers to the Bukavu series and has worked as a research assistant for many Western researchers in Rwanda, Burundi, and Eastern Congo. He recounts that whilst undergoing his PhD research, he encountered personal and collective dilemmas, which led him to start discussing research collaborations and ethics. He gives the example of four experiences and argues they are both commonplace and dangerous. They become rationalities which reproduce certain patterns and logics.
The first, research collaborators in the South are looking for nothing more than making money. For me, this is too reductive and dangerous because money is only a small element of a wall. It is not the first reason for the collaboration. Most of the research collaborators are interested and passionate about research. They are ambitious. Research is an opportunity for them to build networks, to become legitimate in their field of interest, to search for mentorship. So for me, this hypothesis is very dangerous. The second, research collaborators are not good at writing articles. To my point of view, a collaborative research process must consider the whole process as the whole process. It should not stuck on a particular stage of the process. Because I know that from my experience, the research collaborators often participate in three-quarters of the research process. In addition, it cannot be presumed that someone cannot write properly before having invited him to co-write. So this is for me problematic. The third hypothesis is this one. They do not need publication. Very often, I can see that because this is something I saw in my experience. Senior researchers do not ask about our needs, our ambitions, our interests in the process of research collaboration. They just send us to the field, but they don't want to know more about us, more about what we need, what we want. You see? So writing opens new opportunities for us and for research collaborators, and it contributes to secure and legitimate the research collaborators. The fourth hypothesis for me is they did not write the project and did not negotiate the funding. So my question is, how do you think they can write if nobody consults them in advance? They can participate in drafting the project, in negotiating the funding, if they have not been involved.
But how can we explain these unfounded assumptions and unwillingness to engage from Global North researchers? For Emery, These are rooted in historical attitudes and biases. He continues, offering 4 points of analysis.
First, for me, the Global North Collaborative posture, the Global North Researchers Collaborative posture, as the reproduction of colonial past. The Western researcher has difficulty emancipating himself from a colonial past in which the colonized South is viewed as a subaltern, as a subordinate. Whoever he can be, whatever you are, a professor, student, politician, it's the same because there is this colonial past which resonates in some attitudes. This is the first analysis I made. The second, for me, privilege is a trap for the Global North researcher. So alongside a socio-historical socialization, which constructs him or creates him the pretension of being superior to the South, financial means are given to the Global North researcher to conduct research in the Global South. Now, privilege and financial means become powerful instruments which allow him to dominate, to define and impose the conditions of collaboration, to dictate epistemologies and methodologies. We are in this kind of metaphor of the hand that gives is the one that commands. This is the second critique for me. The third, the financial and political conditions of the Global South researcher is a factor that facilitates scientific colonialism. The Global South researcher is trapped by the post-colonial states. His research is neither founded nor valued. This exposes him to begging and depending on a Global North colonized by its hegemonic historical past, which it struggles to quit. Thus, the researchers from the Global South are often obliged to accept difficult collaboration conditions in order to survive and maintain their presence in the research community. Mediocre salary, lack of contract and insurance, imposed epistemologies and methodology, imposed research projects, and so on. Fourth, and this is the last critic for me, I think some Global North researchers suffer from a blind positionality. For me, the fact that they are stuck in the posture of researcher donor, because they got money, you know, they got the project, they look like they are the donors, and you know, they are more than researchers, they are also donors, you know, they come with money, they come with the project, they come with everything. So, and they are in the comfort of power relations, and this makes it difficult for researchers from the North to understand the complexities of the social universe of the collaborator from the South. By opening too little space for dialogue with the collaborators and by limiting himself to the strict framework of the research, he does not see or understand what the other really is, what he needs, his problems and his knowledge. So the project looks like the only thing that is interesting for him, but not the researcher or the collaborator himself.
So an alternative conception of North-South research seeks as far as possible to deconstruct these power relations by developing an approach based on collaboration and a mutual dialogue. These obviously cannot entirely overcome the structural power relations Emery describes, especially when Northern researchers enjoy status as grant winners come donors, which reflect huge structural inequalities of money and power. But researchers who are more aware of these issues and give real thought to them can take steps to mitigate their effects. Doing so improves the quality of research. It means developing collaborative approaches that generate more sophisticated and nuanced outcomes, which take much better account of their local settings. This approach may be able to assist in overcoming what decolonial scholars have called cognitive domination. Dr. Luwazi Leshaba is a lecturer at the University of Cape Town. This is how he describes cognitive dominance.
So cognitive domination simply means that those who colonize us, the white settler colonizers, or the white settler minority, has given unto itself the responsibility to craft concepts and categories with which we think about our own reality.
We might also call this a Eurocentric bias in the concepts and categories that we draw on. Research practice that overcomes such problems will require collaborative dialogue, and it might also point to the formulation of concepts and ideas through empirical observation and fieldwork. This would then make dialogue with both research subjects and researchers part of the process of co-creating new ideas and conceptualizations. While there is already good practice in this area, breaking out of these logics requires continuous effort.
Part 3. Decolonization is multidimensional. The importance of gender.
The blogs published as part of the Bukavu series recall experiences that will be familiar to many local researchers across a variety of country contexts. An aspect we have sought to foreground with this project is the role of gender, and specifically the experiences of being a woman in conflict and post-conflict environments. Indeed, many female researchers attest to the difficulties of navigating a conflict landscape and what may often seem like a burden of carrying out research. These are not solely imposed by Global North institutions and mindsets, but are often manifested in cultural attitudes, behaviours and customs amongst particular communities. Irim Bahati is a Congolese researcher at the Study Group on Conflict and Human Security and teacher at the Higher Pedagogical Institute of Bukavu. Her research focuses on human security for women and children, taxation and the informal economy in cross-border trade, and the socio-economic study of human movements in the Great Lakes region. Irene is one of the contributing authors to the Bukavu series. She discusses her experiences.
In 2018,
I went in a mining site in the eastern DR Congo where people took us for prostitutes, which are called ikomogs.
And in her blog, Irene writes,
our arrival sparked general chaos in the site, with everyone shouting, the ikomogs are coming, which was to say, new prostitutes have been recruited. We were mocked throughout our research in a way that even posed a certain kind of threat. One of my female colleagues observed, if it was just us women here, the prostitutes might fight us, thinking that we've come to steal their men, or we could end up raped by these miners.
This is obviously a shocking experience and situation. It is highlighted by the Bukavu series to demonstrate the multidimensional nature of the ethical issues faced by researchers in some conflict sites.
There are many similar challenges, for example, in a family or in a professional field where people think they do not have the skills for such professions and should stay at home. It's a function of social stigma. Confronted with these challenges and traumas, many female researchers migrate towards other professions and fields where there are not that many stigmas and stereotypes.
In light of these difficulties, IREN launched an initiative to create space for female researchers.
Today, faced with all these problems, many female researchers tend to quit the field because they can be qualified as prostitutes, for example, or faced with mockery and jokes. And this is why, in 2019, I launched an opportunity to talk with other women on the question of research in the field, and we called that the Grenelle for Women Researchers.
Et ces plateformes aujourd'hui s'appellent Grenelle de femmes chercheuses.
Grenelle is a term used in French politics. It refers to a very important plan or a consultation and underlines the issue is being taken extremely seriously, requiring a major effort. The initiative taken by women researchers is an opportunity to talk about the challenges and traumas they face in the field. However, it is important to stress that women researchers do not only face problems, they can often access difficult data that is not easily reachable by their male counterparts. Yuren argues this can bring important advantages to being a woman in the field.
Beyond these problems, the professional female researcher does not only face challenges, but also has advantages. For example, in the context of sexual violence, female researchers get access to different discourses, hidden discourses, because the female victims tend to feel more at ease to confide in a female than a male researcher.
Irene describes a recent example of this during a fieldwork visit to Benin.
Lately, I was in Beni on a field project, of course, before the pandemic and the restrictions. During this experience in March 2020, I could meet female survivors from Ebola, and those female survivors were reticent and even radical in not wanting to talk to male researchers. During the experience, I could speak with the female survivors, and they were definitely more open to talking to me. And that's when I realized that having a mixed team with female researchers also brought advantages.
The project of the Grenelle for Women Researchers seeks to share these experiences, providing a forum and agenda for empowerment, which can aid the production of sophisticated and multidimensional research.
Conclusion.
The Bukavu series, blogs and exhibitions is part of a new era of conversation and learning taking place across the academic community and amongst the whole of society. Through starting difficult but necessary conversations, we can rethink how research has been undertaken to date. The aim of this must be to both address the ethical issues we've discussed and do so in a thorough and not tokenistic way, and also through this process to actually improve the quality of our scholarship by changing the nature of research collaboration going forward into the future.
To find out more information on the Bukavu series blogs and exhibition, visit bukavuseries.com. That's bukavuseries.com. The Bukavu Expo is an initiative led by the Conflict Research Programme and the Governance in Conflict Network at Ghent University. It is a collaboration with the Angaza Institute, Groupe d'études sur le conflit, sécurité humanitaire, ISDR Bukavu, the Jua Programme, and the Firoz Lalji Centre for Africa at the LSE. Thanks to Khadija Kothia and Maylis Etienne for their contributions to this podcast. That concludes this episode of Conflict Zone. We hope you found it informative and educational. Conflict Zone is produced by the Conflict Research Programme at LSE Ideas, LSE's in-house foreign policy think tank. The podcast is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. You can find more information on the Conflict Research Programme at our website. Just put LSE Conflict Research Programme into your search engine and it will come up. The site has details of upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all of our publications. You can also follow us on Twitter at LSE_CRP and at LSE Ideas. Thank you.